Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the bubble quake when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Our federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, our state and local governments also use computers to keep their own files on us. A study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, or the industries you work for or in obtain all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? And what do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it, and let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct, 417-273-4967. Bubble Quake, a book written by David Wiedmeyer. Actually, it's written by four authors: Wiedmeyer, his brother, I think, Robert A., or his father, one or the other, Cindy Spitzer, and Eric Jansen. Each of them, specialists in their own fields, have written chapters, or more than one chapter, in the book called Bubble Quake. He has a chapter here that I'm reporting to you now called Bubble Quake. The book is called America's Bubble Economy. Now, we looked and we saw that there are six or seven of these bubbles. I reported that to you last time. And I also gave you a report from the Privateer showing us that our economy here in the United States, touted to be $12 trillion a year, is actually $8 trillion. $4 trillion of it is newly created money and lent into circulation to keep the engine of liquidity going. We are in hyperinflation. We haven't felt the effects of it yet, but we will in about 18 to 36 months. America is going into hyperinflation. Now, the authors of the Bubble Quake book have pointed out that there will be something happen. We don't know exactly what it's going to be, and we don't know when it's going to be. It may be next month, it may be next year, it may be 5 years from now. But over the long haul, then that's where economics leads us, is over a long period of time, like 1982 to 2000 was the bull market in stocks. But indeed, it did come to an end. And when it came to an end, we Americans, with our investments in the stock market, lost $7 trillion. We took a hit. And now we're back in the stock market, and it has now hit a new high. It's at about 12,500 as I speak, here in January of 2007. But its real value needs to be, or its real high needs to be around 16,000, not 12. And that's just to maintain the purchasing power over the last 6 years, which we have lost because the dollar has lost one-third of its purchasing power. It's gone down from 120 down to about 80 now. And it's on its way from 80 down to 40. And so when we're sitting here with our dollar-denominated assets, we are going to take a hit when it goes from 80 down to 40 over a period of time, not days or weeks, but over the next few years, we're going to take another hit. A slow, insidious loss in our standard of living. A slow, insidious, inflationary loss. It's kind of like having Alzheimer's disease or Lou Gehrig's disease, where over a long period of time, there's this slow, inexorable loss of memory or muscle control until finally you die. Now, the ultimate end of this is the death of our economy. And that's why we're making the report. I'm a reporter, so I'm here reporting to you. Here's what the experts think. And more than just the conservative experts, the reason I'm making this report is because this guy is a conventional, everyday, garden variety, mainstream economist. And he wrote a book and said, well, let me tell you where I think we're headed. Exactly where all of the right-wing, radical economists that I've been reporting on for years say we've been going for years. It's just that it takes a long time to get there. But boy, when it gets there, it's going to be an exciting ride. Now, the thing I liked about the Bubblequake book was that he points out in several chapters, here's how to make money. Position yourself and make money while you're at it. And I reported to you earlier in this series that in the 1920s, people positioned themselves in 1926, 27, 28, and 29, so that when the economy collapsed, they came back into the market a few years later and bought stocks that were selling for hundreds of dollars in 27 for 10 cents on the dollar or a nickel on the dollar or pennies on the dollar in 1935 to watch those stocks go up or to watch those housing investments go up, and then they made profits again. So there are great opportunities when there is an economic collapse. Don't think for a moment that money isn't being made or isn't going to be made. And so for us little guys down here at the bottom, you know, the guys that don't have $30 billion to invest like Warren Buffett, but maybe we've got $30,000. Maybe we've got $3,000. Maybe we've got $300. Better to have $300 in a half ounce of gold that's appreciating than $300 invested in something that's losing money. Now, going on in the Bubblequake book, significant withdrawal of foreign money from the United States could force interest rates to climb as high as 20% or more. I can remember 20% interest rates in 1979, 80, 81, 82. I remember that. Boy, that was a tough time. We got through it, of course. And the economy didn't collapse at that time. We thought it was. We said, hey, this is the big one, as they say in California. Hey, here comes the big one. No, it wasn't. And then we went through an 18-year bull market period. I mean, 1982 to 2000 was a neat ride, wasn't it, kids? Okay, but it came to an end with a $7 trillion hit. And then Alan Greenspan primed the pump again. He started printing money. So from 2000 to 2006, they inflated our money supply, and our dollar value, our purchasing power, went down by 30%. In 6 years, 6%. Now that's inflation. But now they're inflating the economy at 11.9% per year. And boy, that's going to come back with a vengeance in about another 2 or 3 years. And that's about the lead time that it takes. You start your inflationary cycle today in 2007 at 12%, and that will hit us about 2009 or 10. So get ready for it, because here it comes. Now, there's a fierce fight to save the dollar. And like two great stock manipulators, China and Japan, they have both done a heroic service in maintaining the price of the dollar. They're working very hard to maintain the value of the dollar. And after all, why wouldn't they? They are the two biggest holders of dollars. If I was holding on to an asset, no matter what it was, I would work hard to maintain its value. Now, they've bought a whopping $1.75 trillion worth as of 2005. It's now over $2 trillion in 2007, and almost as much as the U.S. government spends in a year. Even though Japan's economy is only half the size of the United States, and China's is only one-fifth. Even for a nation with an economy as massive as the U.S. economy, buying this much cash would be no small expenditure. How much more can China and Japan afford to buy? And how much more do they want to risk? They do it to save their exports, a powerful motivator for these two countries, to be sure. But there are limits to this power. And even if they wanted to keep it up indefinitely, at some point, they simply will not be able to. Now, as of this writing, our greatest ally in maintaining the dollar bubble is China. China wants and needs the dollar to stay strong in order to continue building their own growing economy. We Americans import lots of their stuff, and there are, however, only so many dollars that China's central bank can buy before it can buy no more. Maybe the task will be passed to our second greatest ally in propping up the dollar bubble, the Japanese. But as of this writing, Japan's central bank has not sought to buy $1 since March of 2004, and it's always possible that Japan will jump back into the dollar buying game when China begins to wane, but doing so costs them real money, a few $100 billion a year, and is seen by the Japanese government as an increasingly risky long-term strategy. Well, let's pause right there and think about that for a moment. Let's suppose that you were lending money to somebody, say your Uncle Harry. Now, Uncle Harry is working every day, and he's producing a bunch, but Uncle Harry drinks quite a bit. And you're watching his drinking, and you're watching his erratic work habits. He's taking more days off. He's not nearly as solid as he used to be when it comes to going to work and saving money. In fact, our Uncle Harry, who used to save money, now doesn't save anything. He's just spending. You love Uncle Harry, and you respect Uncle Harry. But Uncle Harry's drinking, and his non-savings, and his lack of thrift, and his getting more slovenly in his work habits, would that make you a little nervous, especially if Uncle Harry owed you about $10,000? Now, Uncle Harry has always been a good credit risk in the past, and he's always paid his bills on time. Would it make you a little nervous when Uncle Harry comes to you and says, "Hey, listen, I need to borrow another $1,000. You probably would give him another $1,000. Now he's into you for $11,000. Uncle Harry begins to drink more, save less, and work less. He comes to you and says, "Hey, would you loan me another $1,000? You probably would. And maybe another $1,000 and another $1,000 and another $1,000. But as Uncle Harry begins to drink more, work less, and borrow more, pretty soon you're going to come to a point where you say, "You know, I'm throwing good money after bad. And while I really love my Uncle Harry, I'm not sure that I want to throw any more money into Uncle Harry. I think maybe I better back off." And that's just where reality's at, kids. That's what you and I would do. So at some point, China and Japan will choke on dollars. Even if they want to keep buying, at some point they'll simply run out of the money to keep buying those dollars with. There are only three ways that a government can get more money. The first way is to tax their citizens. That's not very popular. A second way is to borrow the money from their citizens. The third way governments can get more money is to simply print more. Now that, of course, creates another problem called inflation. Let me pause right there, kids. That's what our government's doing. They're just printing more. President Bush has said, you know, raising taxes just isn't in the cards. Well, that's what I want to hear. I don't want to hear President Bush come to me and say, well, Gordon, the war in Iraq costs a lot of money. Welfare and food stamps cost a lot of money. The deficits and the interest that we're paying on our borrowed debt costs a lot of money. We've got to raise your taxes by 10 or 20%. Hell, I don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that. None of us do. Well, then, did it ever occur to us that maybe we got to spend less money on the war? Maybe we got to spend less money on education? Maybe we got to spend less money on welfare and food stamps? Well, I don't want to hear that. Welfare recipients don't want to hear less spending on welfare. Bechtel and Halliburton and Boeing Aircraft, they don't want to hear spending less money on the Iraq war. All right, kids, now it's time to wake up and meet reality. Wake up and smell the coffee. At some point in time, this thing is not going to continue the way it is today. We'd all like it to. Hell, I love it. I think this is great. I would like to buy big screen televisions from you and give you a 3x5 card that says, Dear Harry, I promise to pay at some date in the future $2,000 for this big screen TV. Signed, George Gordon. Make me another one next month. Hey, here's another neat thing I'd like to buy from you. Now, when you come to me and say, Hey, Gordon, now it's time for you to pay off. Now I'd like you to give me some gold coins. I'd like you to give me a car, a Caterpillar tractor. Hey, Gordon, I'd like you to work for me for a change. Well, that's not nearly as lucrative as borrowing from you. Having to pay my debts just doesn't really turn me on. I like to borrow. I don't like to pay. Now, to the extent that China finances its purchases of dollars with borrowing, which is an easier solution than taxes, it runs the risk of crowding out other needs for capital and then raises interest rates. This can significantly slow down their own economy, which they won't want to do. It also makes Chinese government bonds more attractive to private investors relative to American government bonds, thus drawing Chinese money out of dollars and defeating the very purpose of borrowing this money from the Chinese to start with, to buy the dollars in the first place. You know, there are limits on just how much China can borrow to buy our dollars. And that also, such borrowing leaves the Chinese government very vulnerable in the event that a collapse in the dollar occurs. So even if China and Japan opt to do one or more of these approaches to get more money to buy our dollars so that we can keep buying their exports, eventually the negative consequences of printing, taxing, or borrowing more money is going to catch up with them, and they will cry uncle and quit. And perhaps Europe will step in and save us. But so far, the Europeans have been pitiful players in the prop-up-the-dollar game. They bought about $200 billion worth, barely as much as the country of Taiwan. Clearly, Europe is not as comfortable with the kind of government economic interventions that Japan and China are so willing to employ. Government manipulation of financial markets is much more acceptable in China, which is not a free market democracy to start with, than it is in Japan and Europe, which do have some semblance of free markets. Beyond their reluctance to manipulate currency, the Europeans may also see efforts to prop up the dollar as a game they will ultimately lose. So in truth, there is no central bank that really wants to buy large quantities of dollars. They do it, and they do it because they have to. They do it because it's a last resort when private investors fail to buy enough to maintain the dollar's price. Now, the fact that China and Japan have felt the need to buy nearly $2 trillion in U.S. dollars certainly shows that the demand for dollars by private investors is down. Private investors are losing interest in buying our dollars because they're losing confidence in the profit potential that the United States assets used to have. So private investors, that's you and me, we take a look at it and we're getting kind of nervous. Hell, I've been nervous for the last 30 years, about as nervous as a whore in church. But that hasn't translated into the general population of America. Most Americans are bullish on America. And they're excited about work and excited about the economy. That's most of us. Not all of us, just most of us. But as I mentioned, you know, with Uncle Harry, you know. Hey, listen, I'm really bullish on Uncle Harry too. But you know, as he drinks more, parties more, spends more, goes deeper in debt and works less, I take a look at that and those combinations of character facets, and I say, listen, I'm not sure that old Uncle Harry's going to be able to pay this debt back to me at some time in the future. I had confidence in him in the past, but I'm getting a little nervous now. Now, investors around the world are getting nervous about the American dollar. The American dollar, which was at 120 on the dollar index, is now down to about 80. And its real value is down around 40, which is where it's headed. Ultimately, it's going down to 40. So if you're hanging on to dollars over here, when it reaches 40, you'll have lost half of your purchasing power. That's why I said... Don't you think maybe like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, you ought to diversify out of the dollar, buy euros, which are going up in value? Because when the dollar goes from 80 to 40, the euro is going to go from 130 up to about 180. And that's just where reality's at. May even go higher than that. So Warren Buffett is positioning himself into euros. And that's one of the recommendations from the book here on Bubble Quake. Let me tell you about the author again. It's David Wiedemeyer, David, W-I-E-D-E-M-E-R, is the author. The book is America's Bubble Economy, Profit When It Pops. It's a book written by a mainstream economist and has a lot of neat ideas in the book about how little guys like you and I, the carpenters, plumbers, and blue-collar workers of America, can profit by getting out of debt and putting your assets into something more intelligent, and then positioning yourself in your employment to take advantage of the opportunities that are going to avail themselves when the bubbles start to pop. Now I want to shift back to the privateer for a minute. Remember, the privateer is put out by William A.M. Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, down in Australia. This guy I mentioned last time puts out a newsletter twice a month, 25 issues a year. It's a good primer for little guys like us. This is an education. If you want to learn how money works and how the economies of Australia, Europe, Asia, the United States are working in sync with one another and who's doing what to who, this guy Buckler probably is the best guy for that. The newsletter is about $130 a year American. It's 180 Australian, but I did a little research and it's around 130 bucks, about the same price as the international forecaster. He points out here the global crisis that is and the one that is to come. The crisis that is, the one that is presently taking place, is of course the toxic credit situation inside the United States, where $4 trillion of the $12 trillion economy is being borrowed into existence every year. Boys and girls, that's preposterous. That's insane. And you don't have to be an economist to figure out that, my God, borrowing one-third of what you're spending and then calling that your income is nonsense. And that's what we've degenerated to. And that's why Buckler points out that we are delusional here in America. We've got a delusion going on here. Now, these gauges are transparent and commodities, and they're both ringing loud alarm bells for the U.S. economy. Domestic trucking shipments here in the United States declined by 9% in November. I'm going to pause there. I'm going to underline. Trucking shipments, kids, declined by almost 9% in November. I'm speaking to you in January. We're just looking back here 2 months to November. The November numbers come out in December. 30 days ago, we found out that our November trucking sales dropped by nearly 10% in 1 month. Hey, kids, that doesn't sound good. But it gets worse. It's the largest year-over-year decrease in 6 years. Since the recession of 2000, that's the last time that we had that kind of a decrease. Well, if we had a recession in 2000 with that decrease, what does that tell you for 2007, 2008, or 2009? Now, the American Trucking Association said that its seasonally adjusted truck tonnage index stands at its lowest level since late 2003, following an 8.8% decline versus the same month a year ago. The index fell 3.6% from the prior month. Now that's more than two-thirds of all U.S. manufactured and retail goods that are carried by truck. The industry is a U.S. economic bellwether. All right. Now remember, in the Bubble Quake book, you have a certain amount of time to get positioned. What we don't know is how much time do you have. I mean, if anybody had that kind of a crystal ball, we would ride the stock market up to March 11th and then sell, so that when the market peaks on March 12th, 2000, we have gotten every dollar's worth of growth out of the market. I can remember when I was a kid, we used to run our tires on our cars until they blew out. So, you know, you run skins on your car anyway because you could buy these skins for a dollar. So for $4, you could retire your car with skins. Those are tires that normal people have taken off of their cars and put new tires on. And so when you're a teenager, like when I was a kid, you go down, you buy those for a buck, and you put four of those on. Now you've got four skins, and you drive those until they just blow out. And every time one blows out, you put on another one. You carry two spares with you in your trunk, you know. And you just drive them until they're gone. That's getting the last possible mile out of every tire. When the thing finally blows out, you know that you've gotten the last mile out of it. Hey, boys and girls, we're driving our economy until we get the last mile out of it. I wish I could tell you when that last mile is coming up, but like a tire that blows out, you never know when it's going to go. It's just a bang, and there it is. Now, normal people, you know, want to prevent having a blowout. That's why they changed their tires when they got down to where they didn't have any tread on them anymore. You know, when the tread wore off, you said, well, it's time to put on tires. Now, I'm an old man today. When my tires get down about half wore out, that's when I change them. Because you start having flat tires and I'm getting too old to change them. Now, there's a thing called the reversion to the economic mean. Return to the economic mean, or the real mean average of the economy. Now we'll take that up. That's one of Buckler's neat stories when we come back. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website also. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. That's because most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans. And their viewpoint is not totally endorsed, or not typically totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, or the management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. I want to remind you that we're going to, or we plan to hold a school in Austin, Texas, Tax and Status School, on February 26th through March the 2nd of 2007. That's a little more than a month away in Austin, Texas. Again, that's February 26th through March the 2nd. If you want more information or if you'd like to attend, call us here at the law school at 417-273-4967 or send us an email. And I also need some Indian Black salve, so let me remind you of that again. If you're a Indian Black salve user or supplier, give me a call if you would, please. And then a final reminder that we're offering a new class on health and healing here at the law school, which covers the alternative health methods, alternative medicine for the treatment of cancer and degenerative diseases, and how to prevent these degenerative diseases, and the use and application of essential oils, super nutritional foods containing more nutrients and fewer calories, and acupressure application and training so you can find pressure points and maintain your health. Class in this health school starts February 5th, goes through the 9th. It's a 5-day school, February 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 here in Isabella, Missouri. If you're interested, call the law school at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the coming bubble quake. I thought that was a very catchy title. Bubble quake. Now, I just talked to you about the trucking industry took a 9% hit in November. In commodities, copper has spoken. Copper, which is the main indicator of the state of the economy, being used in numerous places throughout modern economies. Global copper prices have now broken down. In fact, just about the entire global metal sector has suffered steep falls in prices. Across the metals field, the boom is over. Over the first week of January, the CRB index dropped 5.3%, and the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index sank 6%. The gauge which shows that U.S. recession has now begun. Now, the international forecaster reported that the recession, that is, two quarters of negative growth, began back around June of 2005. And that's because the government statistics are lying to us. They're telling you, hey, listen, the economy is growing at 1.6, 3.5, or 4.4%. You know, just take a number, that's what they're telling you. What they're not telling you is that they're inflating the economy by about $4 trillion a year. That's right, we're borrowing about one-third of what we're spending. That's not growth, kids. So when you subtract that out, you've got negative growth. And there's been negative growth now for nearly 18 months. So the nation, the economy is in recession, has been for a long time. Your government's still not reporting that to you. Now, the U.S. yield curve was negative for most of 2006. The U.S. recession has already begun between 7 and 10 months after it first happened. And there have been no exceptions to this rule. The U.S. recession is here. Now, you might not have felt it yet because you haven't been laid off, but it's on its way, kids. Now, America's trade deficit has fallen for the third straight month. The U.S. trade deficit for November declined by 1% to $58 billion, which is the lowest since July of 2005, the U.S. Commerce Department reported on January 10th. Now, the U.S. trade gap hasn't fallen for three consecutive months since 2003. The overall U.S. trade deficit for 2006 is running at an annual rate of $765 billion, which puts the U.S. on track for a new record imbalance for the fifth consecutive year. The deficit for all of 2005 was $716 billion. The economically notable point here is that the U.S. trade deficit has fallen now for three straight months, even though it's a very small amount. However small, the decline 3 months in a row shows that a trend has now started. The United States is at its apogee, which is going to be followed by its descent. So at this point, the U.S. economy is just past the point of its apogee. It cannot ascend any higher. It is now entering the first stages of its economic descent. Future economic history will look back at the past two decades of this U.S. economic policy and note that the United States had become fatally dependent upon foreign finished products, foreign energy supply, and foreign credit, just like any other third world nation. And when any economy goes below the historical mean for practical purposes, the classical theory of the business cycle starts with an economy at its mean. It then puts in place a credit expansion, which in turn accelerates the economy above its mean track of normal economic advancement. Then, for as long as the credit expansion is there and is accelerating its credit issuance, the affected economy and its markets will advance upwards. Behind this artificial, albeit debts are also climbing, albeit at a slower rate than the valuations of land, buildings, plants, and shares on the stock market. But once a credit expansion slows down, even slightly, After a delay, some prices and valuations will break then to the downside. And if the credit expansion slows very fast, vicious and fast downside breaks in prices and valuations will follow. In most past real credit contractions, there have been many cases where there were no prices for shares, no prices for land, no prices for buildings, plant, or equipment. The economy simply goes into free fall. The reason for this was that most people were holding on to their remaining cash, seeing that as a matter of survival. And then an absence of prices signals the absolute maximum of illiquidity. This is called a deep depression. Deep depression. Now, going back to the Bubble Quake book, they have a chapter or a section here that talks about buying back in too fast. You don't want to buy back in too fast. And that's because in 1929 through 35, there are ups and downs in the market. Keep this in mind. In 2000, when we watched the stock market bubble pop, it doesn't pop on March the 12th and go from 11,700 down to 7,200 by the afternoon of the day in question. No. It takes several months for this to unravel. So, just like on a crap table, you know, you walked up to the table and you had a couple $100 and you started playing. And pretty soon you look down and, gee, you got $1,500 sitting there. Now, when you got to $1,500, it was time for you to quit. But you didn't. You stayed there and, oh my gosh, You increased it to 3,000. Wow! You know, you stayed in the game and, hey, the dice are hot, and now you're at 3,000. Now's the time for you to get the hell out. But no, you stayed right there, and you played some more, and lo and behold, pretty soon you're at 6,000. Now you're totally convinced that at this point in time, these dice are so hot they'll never cool off. I'm going to go from 6 to 12, and 12 to 24, and 24 to 48. I'm going to stay here on this crap table. I'm going to break the bank. I'm going to win it all. That's what every gambler believes. I know, I'm a gambler. And when the dice are running hot, this is no time to quit. I've never seen a gambler quit winners. I never quit winners. I've never seen one. And when people get into the stock market, they're gambling. And when the market's going up, they get excited. The market's at an all-time record high. Every time you listen to Lou Dobbs, he tells you about how the market has hit an all-time record high, 12,544 on the Dow. I already told you. Last time, I said, hey, listen, when you correct that for inflation over the past 6 years, it has to be at 16,000 plus. It isn't at 16,000. You've been losing money for the last 6 years. You didn't realize that. Inflation is an insidious deception. It's not only an insidious thief, it deceives at the same time. Now you're sitting there with 6,000. You keep playing. And pretty soon, your 6,000 degenerates to 3. And you say, do you say to yourself, well, gee, now that I've lost 3,000 of my 6, I guess it's time for me to quit? No. We've got to stay in the game to get our 3,000 back. So we play some more and our 3,000 degenerates to 1,500 over time. Do we quit at 1,500? No. We've got to stay here till we get back to our 6,000. And we play until we're flat broke. Well, that's the way people behave. That's the way people react over time. Now, if you're smart and you're sitting on the sidelines over here and you're watching this event transpire, you want to jump in here and you want to participate in the profits also. So when the market breaks and it heads down, there have to be buyers. Otherwise, the market simply goes into free fall. was talking to a lady the other day. She's got a house up in Maine, and she said she's had her house on the market for 6 months. Not a single buyer, not a single looker in 6 months has come out to even look at the house. Now, that's a real estate market in free fall. No buyers. Zero. Period. Now, normally, when markets are going down, the market goes from 70,000 to 60,000, 60,000 to 50,000, 50 to 40, 40 to 30. Yes, the market's going down. It's depreciated by half. But the guy that sold for 70 probably took a hit from 80. The guy that bought it at 60 thought he was getting a bargain because instead of 70, he paid 60, but he turned around and sold it for 50. The guy that bought it at 50 turns around and sells it at 40. The market is going down. It's fatal, boys and girls, to buy into the market as it's going down. You got to wait until it hits the bottom and makes a solid bottom hit and then starts a recovery coming back up. So you wait until the market hits the bottom at 30, and then when it comes back up to 40 and it's made a solid recovery of 10, then you might want to come back into the market little by little. And that's what Wiedemeyer is pointing out in one of his chapters. He says, now don't get panicky. The market is going to decline. Now what they're talking about is a soft landing. You heard that term? Soft landing. What that means is, if we have a soft landing and the dollar goes from 80 on the dollar index to 40, and it does it over a year or two, that's called a soft landing. That means that you're going to lose half the value of your money, half the purchasing power of your money, but you won't notice it. Whereas if the market breaks and goes from 80 to 40, and you suddenly lose half of your purchasing power, and you recognize that you lost half of your purchasing power, that's a disaster. That shakes confidence. And all of the lending institutions, banks, and governments know that. That's why they want this to be orderly. We all know it's going down by half, and we want it to be a soft landing. We don't really want to know that we're losing our money. Now let's wake up to reality, kids. Not only is it coming, now's the time to get the hell out of dollars. Let's wait until the thing bottoms out at around 40, and then we can come back into the market and start buying again. Now that's the way to make money. Whether you got 300, 3,000, 30,000, 300,000, or 3 million. You want to buy at the bottom, not at the top. Boys and girls, we're at the top. I told this lady the other day, I said, well, you missed the top of the housing market in June of 2005. It's too bad. But you know that's where you're at today. So in January of 2007, you're going to sell your house at something less than you could have in 2005. That's called a loss. But you know you're better off taking a 10, 20, 30% loss than taking a 50, 70, or 90% loss, aren't you? So now's the time to get out while you can and then conserve your cash in something that's appreciating. And that's where the bubble economy, that's where the book on cashing in on America's bubble economy, Profit When It Pops, comes in, because this guy, Wiedemeyer, who's a conventional, normal, everyday garden variety economist, says, hey, listen, this is unsustainable. Hell, your president. President Bush says this is unsustainable. We got to have some changes. And that's why we have war in Iraq, because we need the war in Iraq as a sponge to soak up the dollars that government is pumping into circulation. And that's why we need a war with Iran. And that's why a war with Iran is now in the cards. This war with Iran will help us spend more dollars into circulation so that we can pump up the bubble a little bit more, a little bit more. I got to relate to you. I did a program here not too long ago, and I was watching President Bush with his surge program. Have you been listening to the news? He's selling us on the idea that we need this surge because a loss in Iraq is unacceptable. Boys and girls, that's what Adolf Hitler did at Stalingrad. He said a loss at Stalingrad is unacceptable. And so they put in all of their reserves. And then they got cut off. and lost the entire army. Boys and girls, that's what we're being set up for in Iraq. I had to report this to you. Our army in Iraq is being supplied by a supply line that's 600 miles long. And in military terms, that's not good, a 600-mile supply line, especially if your supply line goes through enemy territory. So to secure the pipeline, we had this alliance. It's called the Alliance of the Willing. And little countries, you know, like the Philippines and Japan and Poland and little countries, they sent, you know, 300 guys. Portugal, I think, sent 300 men, 300 troops. And by banding all these troops together, they secured the pipeline, the supply line from Kuwait to Baghdad. And then, little by little, we became to depend upon them. Our troops are fighting the insurgents up in Baghdad and in other places in Iraq. And now the British are pulling out. And then all these little countries are pulling out and leaving the supply line unprotected. That's what happened to the Germans at Stalingrad. Their supply line was getting further and further away from Berlin. Now, this supply line is on both sides of the Tigris River, or the Euphrates River, and it runs up to Baghdad 600 miles. And these two roads are the supply lines, period. Now, this goes through Shiite territory. Now, did you notice the other day that the president said, we're going to send 20,000 troops into Baghdad, and we are going to take on the Shiite militias and stop the sectarian violence? Well, okay, let's suppose the president is successful, and let's suppose that the president attacks this Shiite militia in Sadr City. And let's suppose that we really tick off the Shiites like we have ticked off the Sunnis. And our supply lines, which run through the Shiite section of the country, causes the Shiites to rise up in rebellion, and they start setting off all these roadside bombs alongside the two supply lines over here, and they start attacking all of the convoys that are going through the area, and they shut off the supplies going to our troops in Baghdad. Won't our army, won't our expeditionary force, like the British in France, be cut off? Won't they be encircled? And somebody says, well, we'll supply them by air. No, you won't. The Germans tried that at Stalingrad, and we did that in the Berlin airlift. And we're not going to succeed in a airlift. You can airlift a lot of guys out of there, or you can airlift a lot in there, but it's nowhere near enough. That's the point. I just thought I'd share that with you because I'm not sure but what our president is an agent provocateur. After all, he belongs to the Skull and Bones fraternity, remember, the think tank. And remember that the powers that be are trying to destroy the American economy, which they have succeeded in doing now. And they're in the process of destroying America, and they have succeeded. We have an invasion army inside of our borders of 20 million Mexicans. And while our minds has been focused on Iraq and Afghanistan, we have been invaded over the past 6 years by an army of 20 million. All things are changing here in a big way. And these prophecies that we see in Bible prophecy, you know, in Ezekiel 5 and 6 to talk about nuclear bomb war, and the prophecies by Moses in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. You know, boys and girls are coming to pass right in front of our eyeballs. So I just thought I'd throw that out there as a consideration. And next week I'm going to report on strategic relocation. Strategic relocation. You know, it might be in your best interest if you live in Austin, Texas, to strategically relocate yourself somewhere else. In the same way that you might want to strategically relocate your economic fortunes somewhere else. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are doing that. I reported to you that out of 167, I believe it was, chief executive officers, these are the guys like Ken Lay who are running corporations like Enron. I mean, these are the guys that are sitting at the top of the apex of the business world. Are they buying stocks? No. For every stock that they buy, they're selling 68. For every stock that Bill Gates is buying, he's selling 68. For every stock that Warren Buffett is buying, he's selling 68. What does that tell you? I mean, you know, most of us aren't in the stock market anyway. We're not big investors. We're not multi-billionaires. You know, we're just the blue-collar workers. But hey, kids, we all have houses. We've all got cars. We've all got bills to pay. And positioning yourself to weather this storm is just as important, in my view, for Joe Sixpack as it is for George Bush. And I want to point out, did you know that George Bush and the cabinet and every member of Congress has a fallout shelter to fall back to? Yeah, that's right, a taxpayer expense. You go to Camp David and they've got a big underground bunker there, just like Hitler had in Berlin. And it's well appointed and well stocked. And that's where the president's going to ride out this nuclear bomb war. That's where the Congress, they've got strategic locations where they're going to be relocated so that the intelligentsia of America, all the political high muckety mucks, you know, the Condoleezza Rices, the George Bushes, all the cabinet members, all the members of Congress, probably your governors and your legislators, those are the guys. They've got places. They've got safe places. They've got locations to go to weather the storm. Well, what in the hell have you and I got? You know, what do we have, the guys that are out here on the road pounding the pavement? What do us guys have that are over here building the buildings and doing the work? Yeah, I say it's time for us to start thinking about ourselves for a change. Now that we've provided the safe havens for the intelligentsia, how about the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives? I'll report on that to you next time. Meanwhile, let me give you a reminder here that this is the Privateer. You might want to get a copy. It's the mid-January issue, number 569. And the address here is, well, why don't you go online and go to the-privateer.com. And that'll give you the information you need, the-privateer.com. Or you can send them an email. It goes to capt@the-privateer.com. The other book, remember now, is called The American Bubble Economy, America's Bubble Economy, Profit When It Pops, and it's written by David Wiedemeyer, or Wiedemeyer, W-I-E-D-E-M-E-R. A couple of dynamite publications. I think it'll help you, Joe and Sally. Hey, we're running out of time again. We're just running out of time every time when it's just getting interesting. And so let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are brought to you in the public interest. Hey, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course, until then. Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.